Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome some students today. We have students from Valley Christian High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. We have students from, is it Roncalli or Roncalli? I always forget. Roncalli High School. Would they please stand? School has often visited us. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have students from Wisconsin Valley Lutheran High School. Would they stand, please? And thank you for coming. You may be seated. Students are here with our Court with Class program, which is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar and this court. We invite high school students from around the state to come and join us for an oral argument. If the invitation is accepted, the students are given the briefs for the case, and they may engage in some activities related to the case. Part of the program, the students will meet with a justice of this court after the second oral argument. Everyone is invited to attend that meeting with the justice. The discussion will be on the procedures of the court in deciding cases to take, hearing the case, and then deciding the case. We don't discuss the substantive issues of law involved in the case. We have summaries of the case we are about to hear, and if anyone would like a summary, would you raise your hand and the marshal will deliver it? Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. And on the far right, Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductions made, I'll call our second case, 05AP2257, Walter Olson versus Town of Cottage Grove. Arguing on behalf of the Town of Cottage Grove is Attorney Paul Kent. Mr. Kent.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Kent and I'm here today on behalf of the Town of Cottage Grove. Sitting with me at council table is my colleague Connie Anderson, who also serves as the town attorney. Now, before reviewing the issues before the court, I think it's important to note what this case is not about. This case is not about the validity or wisdom of the transferable development rights ordinance of the town. Those issues were not decided below and are not before the court at this time. The fundamental question that is before the court is one of broader jurisprudential policy, and that is whether trial courts should retain the discretion to determine whether a matter is ripe for review. Now, a trial court's role in making that determination should not be minimized or viewed as mere formality. Determining whether a case is ripe is an essential judicial function to develop a coherent body of law. A case has to be ripe in order for a court to make a good decision. It's about giving the court sufficiently developed facts so that they can reach a well-reasoned decision. And without them, the court is more likely to issue a theoretical or hypothetical decision. Ripeness is about timing. It is about making sure that the decision is made at the point where there can be a, quote, conclusive adjudication for the litigants. Ripeness determinations are also an essential trial court function that allows trial courts to effectively manage their dockets.
Counsel, I have a question about the facts. I'm looking at page 6 of Judge Bartel's decision, where she quotes from Gregory Murray's affidavit regarding the Dane County Board of Supervisors petition 8598. And I'm curious as to what this means to both parties, and so you represent the town, so I'm going to ask you first. The question before the board was Supervisor Halsey's motion at the last county board meeting to rescind action on zoning petition 8598, Town of Cottage Grove. Motion carried. Moved by Supervisor Halsey, seconded by Supervisor O'Loughlin, to extend for 1 year the delayed effective date. Motion carried. Which effective date are we talking about? Is it the effective date for the rescission to take effect, or is it some other effective date?
The precise procedural history here was that there was an original rezoning, and I just want to make sure that because this had been before the board a number of times, I want to make sure that I answer the court's question correctly. Effectively, what was done was there was an original approval, a conditional approval that was there. They then moved to extend that, but they rescinded that action. So essentially, it is the effective date of the zoning approval that was rescinded. So the upshot...
That part I understand. It's the next sentence that concerns me. The next sentence says, to extend for 1 year the delayed effective date. And which effective date are we talking about? Is it the rescission date that's being extended a year? So in other words, the rescission has never taken effect? Or is it the effective date of the prior vote, which has already been, in effect, rescinded according to Judge Bartel's decision? I'm trying to focus on what date we're talking about in these minutes here.
It was the date of the zoning approval. And so essentially they were trying to extend something they'd already rescinded, and that's why Judge Bartel said that it wasn't effective to do so.
And do the minutes of the meetings or do the affidavits make it clear that that's the date that they're referring to?
I believe so, Your Honor. And this was a point that I would note that as we got to the Court of Appeals was no longer contested by Olson. And I would argue that at this point that issue has been waived.
In other words, as of the time this lawsuit was brought, which was in September, there was nothing pending.
That is correct.
Olson had no petitions outstanding. Nothing was pending.
That is correct, Your Honor. That the original that zoning had expired, and by the way, the town's platting authority had also expired by some 18 months, actually.
Counselor, do you agree or disagree that that's relevant if you're using an as-applied analysis? But if you're looking to it as a facial challenge, does that matter?
Well, I think it certainly matters on an as-applied challenge. I mean, we have a situation here where the zoning approval that really triggers this TDR requirement had expired, and whether that was ever going to be gotten again and applied here is... at best a contingent and uncertain event.
Okay, but as a facial challenge, wouldn't that be relevant here too?
Well, I think a facial challenge stands on a little bit different footing, and I think it's important to address your question in the context of some of the arguments that we saw in the amicus brief, which we haven't had a chance to respond to until this time. Okay. I think the first point I would like to make is that on this record, the case has never been postured as a pure facial challenge. And in fact, even as recently as the brief before this court, Mr. Olson has continued to assert this as an as-applied challenge, at least in significant part. On page 20 of the brief before this court, Olson states, "The town cannot reasonably argue, given these facts, that Olson's as-applied challenge to the ordinance is right."
So, but then it goes on to, more importantly, Olson's entitled to declaratory judgment.
That is correct. But what we have is a mixed facial challenge and as-applied challenge. And I guess the question then is, if this is a facial, in the context of a facial challenge and a mixed challenge, Did Judge Bartel abuse her discretion in determining that given this mixture of these events, that more facts should have been obtained? I think that when you look at the facial challenge cases, it's important to look carefully at what they say. What they say is, in general, facial challenges are ripe upon enactment. And that's an observation. It's not an absolute rule. It doesn't divest the trial court of their discretion to make that determination. What it says is, as an observation, in general, that's true. Why is that true? It's true because on a facial challenge, by definition, there are no facts. So nothing is ever going to get riper. There is not going to be a point at which a case is more appropriate for review. So if you have a pure facial challenge, most of the time it's going to be ripe on enactment. But even there, there are cases certainly in the federal system, I didn't see any in state law, where courts will say that even in a facial challenge, there's a role of discretion because a court may, for example, determine that an as-applied challenge makes more sense to hear before you actually get to the facial challenge. There are a number of cases, for example, dealing with overbreadth and under First Amendment. For example, the Board of Trustees of the University of New York versus Fox talks about the fact that it is appropriate for there for a court to look at an as-applied challenge before getting to a facial challenge. I guess
Counselor,
the point...
Just so I understand your answer, just setting aside the as-applied challenge, because there is a facial challenge here, the date of the rescission, whether anything was pending at the time the suit was brought, they're not really relevant to that particular analysis, correct?
I think that's correct if one were to look at the facial challenge by itself.
Right. I understand that. If we were to analyze them step by step, we might do that, or maybe we won't, but I just wanted to be sure I understood.
I mean, if, for example, the case were brought by, say, the Amicus Realtors Association, and they had no facts, and this was simply a straight facial challenge, you know, these dates then become really not that important. Mm-hmm. In the context where you have, you know, some facial challenges, but a lot of allegations about as applied and facts and what the contingencies are here and so forth, in my view, it's entirely appropriate for a trial court to still exercise discretion and say, as a matter of ripeness, there are more facts here that ought to come together so I can render a better decision, because otherwise significant portions or all of this decision are not going to be very helpful.
This was a summary judgment.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it was granted, right?
Yes.
So there are no material facts of issue. The court ruled on any of the affidavits that were presented, right?
Yes.
And any facts of public record. Right?
That is correct.
And any facts probably that you all didn't dispute, but so they would be before the court. I mean, there were no facts. That is, the facts were all set forth. Now, what is your position? Is it you're the town, you don't like the Court of Appeals decision, right?
That is correct.
All right, otherwise you wouldn't be here. So you are, as I hear you, saying, look, the trial court had discretion. The trial court had discretion in a declaratory judgment because that's what the declaratory judgment statute says, right?
Correct.
And trial court looked at facts. Trial court looked at what ripeness means under the law. Trial court looked at all this and said, in my discretion, you shouldn't be here yet. Right?
That's correct.
Okay. So what is the definition of ripeness? Is that a legal standard? I mean, the other side's going to say, okay, it was discretionary, right? But summary judgment is reviewed as a question of law. So now you got declaratory judgment, discretion, summary judgment, law. They're both in this case, right? Let's look at declaratory judgment. The only factor is rightness. That's the only one that's being debated, right? Okay. Is that a question of law or fact?
Well, it's primarily a question of fact in as much as it is applying fact to the law. And it is a discretionary determination that the court then makes based upon that evaluation. I think when you look at, for example, State ex rel Lynch versus Conta, what they say is factual circumstances determine whether this factor, ripeness, is satisfied. And it's because of that inherent fact-based nature of these ripeness determinations, you have the court in Loy versus Bunderson saying this is exactly the area where judicial discretion is supposed to operate.
If this is a facial, as determined on a basis of a facial attack, then I would assume that any property owner who was in the, what's the terminology, residential area, the receiving area.
Receiving area.
Okay. Any person in that area who therefore would have to use TDRs, right, to develop.
If they wanted to develop, that would be a requirement that they would have, of course, the prerequisite being that you have to have the zoning to allow you to do that.
Well, okay. But this ordinance also says, or something also says, you don't have to have the zoning to go ahead and start your proceedings in the receiving area. Isn't that right?
There are, you can get a conditional plat approval. That certainly is a possibility.
And you don't have to wait for the zoning. You get a conditional on ultimately the county giving you zoning.
Right.
All right. So under those circumstances, doesn't anyone in the receiving area who might want to develop, doesn't have to be tomorrow, right, or wants to sell and is going to sell it at a higher price because it's developmental land, right? That a land that can be developed into 58 plots for residential housing. Couldn't any one of them then sue for a declaratory judgment, declaring that 1515 is unconstitutional?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that there's a distinction there between standing and ripeness. I would concede, for purposes of your hypothetical, that they may have a sufficient interest for purposes of standing, which is one of the elements of justiciability. Mm-hmm. But the question on ripeness asks a different question. Is this the right time? Are there facts that could be obtained so as to take this out of this being a contingent circumstance? Or as, you know, the court in Miller Brands, for example, talked about making sure that we have taken those actions necessary to make this a ripe determination. I think that the very nature of a conditional approval highlights the contingent nature of that approval. Yes, it's possible to get a conditional or a contingent approval, but it's contingent upon zoning, which he doesn't have a vested right in having, and there is no guarantee that that's going to happen. It's a contingent event. Now, is it contingent enough? That's a discretionary call for the trial court judge. All of these factors are going to be taken a look at. Has there been, you know, if we had a situation where there was a conditional plat approval but no rezoning, would that be a different case? It might be. In this case, we had neither plat approval or rezoning at the time that this challenge came up. I guess the other point I would like to make in response to your summary judgment question, and I think it is an important one, which is that this inherently discretionary determination has been viewed by this court, I think, on a consistent basis under an abuse of discretion standard. The WEAC versus Elections Board case, the District Council 48 case, and Putnam, all of which I've cited in my brief, all of which use an abuse of discretion standard. But interestingly, they don't all come up on the same procedural posture. The Putnam case, although decided by a divided court, was a motion to dismiss. But even though it was a divided court, the court agreed that the standard of review was abuse of discretion.
Now, some of the other cases, District Council 48, for example, was a decision on the merits. So we shouldn't be in a position where we say, well, if a matter was decided on a motion to dismiss, abuse of discretion applies. If it's decided on the merits, abuse of discretion applies. But if it's summary judgment, all of a sudden we're going to apply de novo standard.
Okay. Let me suppose that we take the discretionary standard. Why didn't the trial court erroneously exercise its discretion here? Olson is a developer, right?
Yes.
So you know sooner or later he's going to develop. That's why he's got this land. All right. He went through many steps and spent money, I assume, to do a variety of things to get a plat, to get zoning approval, right?
He did.
All right. Started in 2001. This didn't end until 2004, and he then sued in 2004. So it's not like he's just sitting back on the rocking chair looking at the land. He's moving or trying to move. All right. So if you take it as a facial challenge, he does have standing. We agreed, or you agreed. And the question is, why isn't it ripe? Got all the facts. He wants to develop agriculture land, and he wants to plat it to be resident, and he wants to change zoning to residential, and he doesn't want to do the TDRs because he thinks it's an imposition on him. Why isn't it right? Why did she validly exercise her discretion? Sounds to me, when I put all that together, that this is just as close to being actual as you can get, short of him refiling everything. That's what she's saying, refile everything.
Well, let me make two observations, and the first is, that's not what the Court of Appeals did here. The Court of Appeals applied a de novo standard. There is nothing in this record to suggest that they evaluated this case on an abuse of discretion
standard. But it's now here.
But it's now here.
We have to evaluate it on abuse of discretion.
And I think that when you evaluate it on that ground, the question is, you know, did she apply the proper legal standard? And I think that she did that. And
the legal standard.
The legal standard is whether, for purposes of ripeness, those events are sufficiently remote or contingent to allow for an effective adjudication of the merits of this case. That was the standard that she applied, and she determined it wasn't. Now, I think in response to your specific question, what I want to make sure that we look at here is, yes, it's true Mr. Olson is a developer. Yes, it's true he's probably going to come back and reapply. Nobody, we're not here to dispute that. But what is contingent here, and what Judge Bartel and Judge Dykeman had, I think, appropriate trouble with, is the fact that the county zoning is not an automatic event here. There is nothing to say that that rezoning is going to be reissued, and in the absence of that rezoning, there is nothing to determine whether or not the TDR ordinance is actually going to take effect here. Essentially, without rezoning and plat approval, it's not possible to determine to what extent that ordinance is going to apply, and any determination is going to be theoretical and speculative. We have
advisory. You're saying it's an advisory opinion.
It's an advisory opinion, and I think the facts in this case bear this out. Had Mr. Olson filed that challenge when he had zoning and plat approval, we'd be in good shape and we could be good to go. That didn't happen until both of those things expired. We don't know whether they're going to reoccur. And in the meantime, the town has amended their zoning order, their transferable development rights ordinance. Things have changed. Development patterns have changed. We have a different set of circumstances here. And so what you want to look for is it ripe at the time that it is filed so you can make the best decision you can as a trial court judge?
Well, the different circumstances, does that go to facial or as applied or both?
Well, I think it certainly goes to as applied. And I guess getting back to the facial challenge issue, I just want to say that, again, we're not dealing with a pure facial challenge here. And because it is a mixed facial challenge and as-applied challenge, I think Judge Bartel appropriately exercised her discretion in saying, look, I want more facts here. I want to be certain that this is actually going to have a result on the litigants, that it is going to be binding and effective and make sense based upon this ordinance and this zoning approval.
What part of this is as-applied and what's facial? You keep saying it's mixed.
Well,
I looked at the complaint. It's in...
The complaint is full of all kinds of facts. Facts which, by the way, on summary judgment were not proven and not substantiated, and Judge Bartel notes that
there is
no basis for those facts, but yet those facts are incorporated in every single one of the six or seven claims that Olson has made here. This is not a case. Unfortunately, we don't have a case that was brought that says, here is a facial challenge based upon statutory authority. What we have are six or seven claims, all heavily fact-based, all because Mr. Olson wants a specific remedy as it applies to his particular property. That's enough of a mixed facial and as-applied challenge that I think it was entirely appropriate for Judge Bartel to say, wait a minute. There's a lot of stuff going on here. I'm not going to decide this case until I'm certain that the zoning issue has been resolved. Now, certainly, Mr. Olson got zoning once. If it's not a big deal, then it's no burden for him to get it again. On the other hand, if he can't get the rezoning, that's precisely the problem we have here. This is not like your typical case where the zoning issue applies and we're simply challenging that zoning. I don't dispute that a facial challenge on that likely ought to go forward. But what we have here is a challenge to a TDR ordinance that doesn't even have come into fruition in terms of imposing obligations until he has the ability to develop. And that doesn't happen until that zoning is rechanged. And that hasn't happened. It might never happen.
Is the TDR ordinance still in effect today? Is that something that's not been changed?
The TDR ordinance that was the subject of this challenge is not in effect. There is an amended TDR ordinance that is in effect.
It's substantially the same?
The basic concepts are the same, but there are substantial amendments that define a number of both exceptions and implementation issues that I think make it significantly different from the ordinance that was back in 2003.
Is the only issue really on this declaratory judgment that's here today the constitutionality of the TDRs, or are we dealing with the way the procedures were made? Because there are several causes of action here. Only some of them are the constitutionality.
That's correct. There are a number of takings challenges and a number of substantive due process kind of challenge. There are also some other challenges that were statutorily based, mm-hmm. all of which were kind of mixed together here based upon those facts. And I think that's why it's appropriate when you have something that is this intertwined for the judge to be able to exercise her discretion under the applicable standards of law and come to a conclusion so that she might be able to make the best possible decision that will address those issues.
And that's why you say it's all intertwined, because you've got all these different provisions.
Exactly, and I think it's appropriate under those circumstances for her to have that discretionary review.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
Attorney John Kastner, representing Walter Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. My name is John Kastner. I'm with the law firm of Murphy Desmond, and I appear today with Matt Moser on behalf of the plaintiff respondent, Walter J. Olson. I'm a bit taken aback by the suggestion that the lawsuit that I filed raised an as-applied challenge. I thought I filed a facial challenge. And I found one sentence in which the word as-applied appeared in a brief and have suggested that somehow in a brief that was written 3 years after I started this lawsuit, I had filed an as-applied challenge. What I was suggesting is that I didn't think they could credibly make an argument that I was making an as-applied challenge.
Well, why didn't you apply? Why isn't it an as-applied challenge? Is it because he no longer has any matters pending relating to the land?
No, Chief Justice Abrahamson. The arguments that the lawsuit made is that the ordinance is valid because they failed to comply with statutes that regulated what they could do, that they failed to comply with the Constitution, and it was things about the... I was challenging the validity of the ordinance, not the way the ordinance applied to my client. I did include a request for supplemental relief. The statute clearly provides that if the court determines that declaratory relief is appropriate and grants the relief that I had requested, which was that the ordinance is invalid, then consequences flow from that determination. The consequences that flow are they approve my client's plat, contingent only upon compliance with the PDR ordinance. They approved it at a point in time when the county had approved his zoning.
Mr. Kastner, if it's any comfort to you, I read your brief as a facial challenge. And I also read your brief as saying, and I'm looking at page 20, any person owning property in a receiving area is entitled by that fact alone to seek a ruling on the ordinance. So anybody in the receiving area that owned property, even if they weren't ready tomorrow to go in and plat and rezone, you think could come up and say, this ordinance is unconstitutional because, one, it wasn't passed appropriately under the statutes. Two, even if passed appropriately under the statute, it violates the takings clause or substantive due process or any other constitutional ground you might want. So anybody, doesn't have to be Mr. Olson, anybody could attack it. Maybe even, is that right? Is that your position?
Yes, it is. And you know, the town and the trial judge tried to make a lot of mileage out of the fact that we didn't file any affidavits in response to the motion for summary judgment, but the key issues that needed to be decided was, number one, did the town adopt an ordinance? Yes, it did. They admit that. Number two, did it affect my client's property? Yes, it did. Did they apply it to my client's property? Yes, they did. But the key thing is, my client owns land that is designated as a receiving area. Any attempt to develop that land will require that he comply with the ordinance unless it's determined that the ordinance is invalid. Now, my client made an effort. Realtors like to get deals done. They're not in the business of suing government. My client made an effort to see if he could comply with this ordinance, but he couldn't.
Mr. Kastner, why is the standard of review important here? Does it really make any difference to you whether it's an erroneous exercise standard or a de novo standard?
Well, the standard of review is important. The Down wants you to agree that you should grant deference to the determination of the trial court, but that would be an incorrect conclusion on your part.
Well, let's assume for a minute that we decide because of 806.04.6, which says discretionary. Let's say that we decide on that basis that, okay, this is an erroneous exercise of discretion standard. Does that mean you lose?
No, it means I win.
Why?
Because the standard does not give the court the freedom to do whatever it feels like doing with regards to ripeness. What the standard says is, and it was pointed out in Loy versus Bunderson, I believe at paragraph 41 and 43, that the court has a very limited degree of discretion when ruling on this issue. The question is decided by whether or not a decision on the question raised by the request for declaratory judgment would resolve the dispute. If an answer to the question will resolve the dispute, the court has to address the question. The court's only entitled to deny review if answering the question posed by the declaratory judgment action won't resolve the dispute. Our lawsuit asked the court to determine that the town's ordinance was invalid. If the ordinance is invalid, we don't need to comply with it. That's the whole question. The town is trying to make this about whether we have zoning or not. This isn't about whether we have zoning or not. The fact of the matter is we had zoning. And when I filed the lawsuit, I thought I had zoning. We went to the county. The county approved the zoning contingent upon recording a plat within a year. That's the way Dane County does all rezones. The year was coming up, and we hadn't been able to acquire the TDRs. My client went to the county and asked the county to extend the time available to him to find the TDRs. And up until that point, the way the county did this was to rescind and recreate with a later deadline. When they did this, they believed they were giving us more time under the zoning that they had previously approved, and I left the county board believing that we now had another year to get our plat approved. And the town had the ability to veto that action, but it didn't do it. And after that meeting, the town met with us on a number of occasions attempting to help us find TDRs so that we could comply with the ordinance. They certainly weren't acting like the zoning had died and the whole issue was irrelevant. We were operating on the assumption when we filed this suit that we had zoning. And we learned after we filed the suit that the judge had determined through some technicality that we got to be the first person that didn't have an extension. We had an invalid extension of our zoning.
Counsel, do you think that Judge Bartel decided this case both on a facial challenge and an as-applied challenge? The issue of ripeness?
I believe that she was applying this as an as-applied challenge and that for some reason she felt the supplemental relief was a part of the principal case and this, it was really intended to be supplemental relief available only if I won on the principal question. And somehow, whether or not I got supplemental relief became paramount and was used as a justification for finding a lack of ripeness, that somehow I needed to prove my supplemental relief before I was able to go forward with the challenge to the ordinance. I think she was wrong. The standard that she applied in deciding this case is entirely contrary to the whole reason we have declaratory judgment. What she ruled is that we hadn't shown that we would suffer great damage if we were forced to comply with the ordinance. And if you uphold this case, you're going to tell every lawyer and every litigant and every judge in this state that there is some sliding scale of damage that has some subjective scale with no standard that would enable a trial judge to refuse to address the validity of a challenged ordinance in a facial case. This is a facial challenge. The realtors got in this case because they care about their ability to bring declaratory judgment actions.
What do you think the Court of Appeals did, as applied or facial?
That's a good question.
That's why I asked it.
I don't have to have answers for all the questions I try to.
That's right. You here.
I will.
You're defending this decision. You're defending it. What does it mean?
I am defending the decision. I believe that the trial court's decision was invalid. I believe it was invalid because it applied an improper standard of law. The standard that it applied was that we had to show a great amount of damage as a consequence of being forced to comply with this ordinance. That can't be the law. I want to read the court a couple of paragraphs. It's too long to memorize. From Mr. Borchard's treatise on declaratory judgments, every major Supreme Court decision in Wisconsin has relied upon this treatise as the source of the law that guides the court as it does what it does. And at page 14 of the preface to the second edition, he wrote as follows. Harm is done, and rights are jeopardized by mere dispute or challenge without any physical attack. The mere existence of a cloud, the denial of a right, the assertion of an unfounded claim, the existence of conflicting claims, the uncertainty or insecurity occasioned by new events, these phenomena constitute the operative facts, the cause for action, which creates the right of action. The court, in rendering a judicial declaration of rights, thus becomes an instrument not merely of curative, but also of preventative justice. The vindication of assailed or challenged rights, the clarification and stabilization of unsettled legal relations, the removal of legal clouds which create peril, insecurity, fears, and doubts. In short, the establishment of social peace in the community without the necessity for prior violence is the primary judicial function. That's why we have this law, to allow people to find out before they spend money chasing zoning whether they have to comply with an ordinance that's going to prohibit them doing the project in the first place. My client believes that if he has to buy TDRs, he can't go forward. He believes they're going to cost too much money. He spent a year trying to get them. He couldn't get them. What they would cost is irrelevant. That they would cost more than $5 is. In deciding the Putnam case, Putnam versus Time Warner, this court decided that people who were being asked to pay a $5 late fee had a valid justification for challenging the ordinance. Their claim was ripe, even though none of the plaintiffs had paid the $5. My client paid engineers to plat this thing. He paid attorneys to go to the county to get zoning. He obtained preliminary and final plat approval contingent only upon compliance with the TDR ordinance. He was many, many, many thousands of dollars down the road on this case before he filed this suit.
Mr. Kasner, the chief asked you about the Court of Appeals decision, and I know that you would like us to uphold the majority of that Court of Appeals decision. Is there anything that you would change in that decision? Is there anything that you would write differently if you were writing the opinion?
I would have said that the trial court applied an incorrect standard of law when it decided. Actually, the court did cite to the fact that it was requiring that we establish harm. I think the court could have said, as the court said in Loy versus Bunderson, and as I believe the court also said in the Putnam case, that you don't have to show any harm to be able to go forward. That the case was ripe from the get-go. And that's our point. Anybody that owns property in a receiving area had the right to challenge this ordinance the moment it was passed.
That's really your point, and that's the way you'd write this decision. Anyone in the anyone that's affected by, and you can fill in, platting ordinance, zoning ordinance, affects their land, affects the what they can do with it, or affects the reasonable value, can challenge the constitutionality thereof, and it's ripe.
Yes, and it seems to me
it's a simple opinion.
No, it seems to me that this court has an important job to do. I've always believed that anyhow. But in this case, it has an important job to do. There's a problem. The cases that have found a lack of ripeness were always as-applied challenges. This was a facial challenge. The court ought to make a distinction as to how the standard works when you're dealing with a facial challenge that's challenging the validity of a law. If the law exists, if it's already been adopted, and it already affects or will impact the way somebody goes forward because they have to comply with that law, that challenge ought to be deemed ripe. And the ripeness issue in that instance ought to be clarified by this court so that we don't have this problem in the future.
Did the circuit court turn this into an as-applied challenge?
I believe the court did, yes.
I'm interested on this business of the extension. Was that briefed before the circuit court?
Yes, it was.
It was?
Yes.
At whose request?
Well, the town filed a motion for summary judgment. And we were obligated to respond to the town's motion for summary judgment. I submitted no affidavits because the town had already admitted the operative facts. And those were that the ordinance had been adopted and that it affected my client's property because he owned property in a receiving area. I thought there was nothing more to say. They had admitted everything I needed. The trial court decided that I couldn't go forward if I didn't have zoning. But if I had zoning, would the court then be able to decide whether I could get financing or whether I could comply with some environmental regulation? If you don't want to decide the question of the validity of an ordinance because your politics might suggest that you don't want to find the ordinance invalid, are we inviting courts to find some condition that might interfere with your ability to actually complete the project? That can't be the standard for a declaratory judgment on a facial challenge. Because people that don't want the law overturned can always find something that might interfere. But the zoning in this case was hardly contingent. We applied for and obtained zoning. When we couldn't get this completed in time, we went back to the county and asked them to extend the time for zoning. And they extended it. But the court has decided that my ability to get zoning is entirely too speculative. There's nothing in the record to suggest that I can't get the zoning because twice the county acted with an intent to approve the zoning for this property. And it's inappropriate for the town to argue that we can't. Their plan, the town's plan, encouraged my client to ask for the zoning. Its plan designates my client's property as an appropriate area to pursue medium-density residential. If it hadn't done that, my client wouldn't have asked for the zoning because they would have said it's inconsistent with the town's plan. The town's plan all but compels the town to encourage the county to grant the zoning. My guess would be that if the town were given the opportunity today, they would oppose the zoning, not because it's inconsistent with their plan, but because we stood up to their transfer of development rights ordinance. That can't be the basis for deciding this.
Could you explain exactly what a TDR is?
I'll do my best.
I mean, how would I go about getting a TDR?
All right. I'm sure you've all heard of conservation easements. There have been a number of cases decided by this court that address the issue of conservation easements. What the town wants people like my client to do is to acquire one transfer of development right for every three residential units they're going to create on a parcel. And in order to provide them with what they will consider a transferable development right, we have to find a farmer in the town and say, you're just a farmer. And if you're willing to stay just a farmer and sell to me a conservation easement that would prohibit you from developing your property for anything other than its present use as a farm, I'll pay you money. I need you to tie up 35 acres of land, give me a price, I'll buy your development rights. Now I have one. This 29-lot subdivision required that my client buy the development rights on 350 acres of land. And he had to buy 10 of them. And when he gets them, he's got to give the deed to the town. He's got to give the deed to the county. And they own the right to stop the farmer from developing his property.
They don't own the land, though.
They
the
own
farmer owns the land.
But it's restricted. The law of this state clearly recognizes that it's an interest in title. It has value. People can pay for it. I think the stewardship fund may have been used to acquire development rights on land. If it hasn't, there's certainly a push to allow it to be used for that purpose at this time.
Are these voluntary under a new ordinance, or what does that voluntary business mean?
Apparently the thought was, we're going to go out to these people that have lands that's more remote in the county who can't develop their land because we don't want them to develop their land because it's too remote to the residential areas of the county or within the township. We want to limit residential development to areas contiguous to where it already exists, such as my client's property that has subdivisions on two sides and a number of platted residential parcels on the third side. So you have to go out and buy these in remote areas of the township where they don't want residential development to occur. Now, the problem is the value of a transfer of development rights. I didn't want to argue the merits of the ordinance because it isn't relevant to the decision before this court, but I'll go there. The problem is, if I buy land in a remote part of the county, I get to buy that land for its straight value as ag land because nobody in their right mind would believe I'm going to be able to develop it. So the price that a farmer can get when he sells that farm is limited by what he can do, what a buyer can do with it. And that is, all he can do is farm it. But when somebody buys property like my client's property, which shows up on the town's master plan as ripe for development, for medium density, the price is not the same as the price in the remote parts of the county. It's based upon the fact that this land is imminently developable. So you pay more. Well, having paid more for your property, now you're being told you got to go to some farmer out on the edge of the county and buy from him what you've already paid for. His land all of a sudden becomes development land, not because he can develop it, because you need his permits. And the price that you pay for the permits from him has nothing to do with the value of his land. It has everything to do with the value of your land. The more valuable your land is, the more you'll pay to get the permits to develop it. That's what's wrong with transfer of development rights. It's taking property out in the remote part of the county and giving them a financial benefit they have no right to.
But didn't your client get a financial benefit because he bought land in a residential area? That is a residential, what the receiving area, isn't that increase the value of that land?
He's already paid for that value.
Okay, sure.
Now he's being asked to pay again.
Well, that's always true in a zoning or platting.
No. He's actually being asked to write out a check and give it to a farmer in the remote parts of the county and then turn around and give the deed to the town.
You're
and
right.
If he gives the deed to the town, the question then becomes, is that an illegal tax on development? Is
that,
it an impact
And that's
fee?
Your substantive argument that we're
yes,
not going to get into.
Which
okay.
we don't need to get to today. Hopefully I'll get to someday.
I looked at the Court of Appeals decision again, and it seems to me they're just saying the trial court goofed in applying rightness, either as an erroneous exercise of discretion or de novo, and that it is as applied. If you think the trial court was as applied, I suggest to you the Court of Appeals was as applied because they went through the exact same concepts that the trial court did as to how hurt your client is, how close to getting what he wanted was, and that it was right because he doesn't have to take the next step of reapplying. He'd already taken all these steps. He'd already had problems. Therefore, he suffered a sufficient enough grounds to go ahead.
In the end, what the Court of Appeals says is that I don't think they say it in so many words, but all of the elements necessary to satisfy ripeness for a facial challenge to the ordinance have been met. My client is covered by the ordinance. He's affected by the ordinance. He doesn't need to show harm as a precondition to being able to challenge the ordinance. I believe that the Court of Appeals said all of those things. I believe that the Court of Appeals was offended by the decision, that they felt that this certainly was a case. Essentially, what the town is arguing is that I started with a ripe facial challenge, and somehow by attempting to comply with the ordinance, I unripened it.
Here's my problem. Take it outside of this case. If we say that anyone who has property and could be affected by this ordinance can challenge it, and that's your position.
Yes.
Okay. I could open up the statute book to a ton of statutes, I'm sure, and I might be close to wanting to deal with the subject matter at issue. You could take a marriage statute. I could challenge the marriage statute on a ground that it's not valid. It's constitutionally invalid because it requires parent approval if whatever your age is. And I'm 13 and I want to get married. I could challenge concealed gun statute on the constitutionality. I don't have to have a gun. I may only want a gun. I mean, there are any number of statutes that if I pushed further, I would, I might want to do something, but they would regulate my doing it, and I might think it's unconstitutional. And if we take a broad standard that you suggest, aren't we opening up the courts to a multitude of lawsuits challenging a multitude of statutes because the person soon might be affected thereby?
No, I don't believe that would be
okay.
The case. All of the case law cites to the four tests.
I'm talking about ripeness.
But there are three other tests.
Okay, which one don't I meet?
Well, you have to have there have to be real adversity between the parties. So I can't, if my client was thinking about buying land in the town of Cottage Grove, I would think that it could be argued that he doesn't have a sufficient adverse interest. He doesn't
I've
have.
I've got an offer to purchase on that land. Is that good enough?
I believe there's case law that suggests that he has to own the property. Because if the offer to purchase were contingent upon my ability to challenge the ordinance, that might not be enough. I have to have an economic interest in the outcome. There has to be a real contest. What you don't want is people being able to bring declaratory judgment actions that aren't going to be legitimate litigants, that are seriously going to challenge the law, that care about the outcome, that have something to gain or lose as a consequence of the outcome.
Well, but passion isn't an element, you know.
Passion is not an element.
Are you done? One of my concerns is the statute. And if I take a look at the statute, 80604 sub 6, I say to myself, this is a little unusual. Discretionary. I mean, it's emphasized. I know that's the heading, and it's not necessarily the legislation. But it's discretionary. Boy, you don't see too many statutes that say discretionary and then continue. And so this is a little unique. And it seems to me that sub 6 is saying that when it comes to, and sub 6 in my mind deals with the issue of ripeness, uncertainty, that touches upon the whole ripeness thing. And we're not, I know there are four elements, and we're not talking about adversity here, and we're not talking about necessarily interest. We're talking about ripeness. This statute arguably says to me the following, that if the court articulates the correct legal standard, that we will give deference to the application of a legal standard. That's the way I look at it. I mean, it doesn't have all those words in it, you know, but this is a deference statute on the issue of uncertainty.
But it's not a deference statute, and I would not read the statute in that fashion. My time is up. May I finish the answer?
Yes.
The statute says the court may refuse to render or enter a declaratory judgment or decree where such judgment, and I'll finish it, would not terminate the uncertainty or controversy giving rise to the proceeding. You can't look at the discretionary nature of this without understanding that it's a very limited grant of discretionary power.
This is to ripeness to me. This is to the whole thing of how you define ripeness. Ripeness is defined in the Miller case, may not be so contingent and uncertain.
If you answered the question that's being asked, but the dispute won't go away, then the court has the deference to refuse to hear the case.
Well,
but in this case, the court clearly can't be saying that this wouldn't resolve the case, because if the ordinance is invalid, the case is resolved.
That's why you're really only fighting about the TRD or TDR.
We're not fighting about the TDR today. We're fighting about whether or not...
But ultimately, the question is, would the controversy be resolved? And the answer is, it's resolved if you say that this receiving and sending and the TDRs are valid. Then he's got to go ahead. You're saying it would be resolved if they say it's unconstitutional, because then he doesn't have to do
that. Well, the resolution, Justice Abrahamson, is that if the ordinance is valid, my client knows that the ordinance is valid, my client has two choices.
Which part
he can
of the
attempt
ordinance?
To comply.
Which part of the ordinance are we talking about?
The TDR ordinance.
Okay, that's all I'm asking. That's really the issue here.
If the TDR ordinance is valid, my client then has two choices, but it's an informed decision. I can attempt to comply, or I can decide that it's too expensive and not even pursue zoning.
Okay, and that's why you say it resolves the case.
Yes.
So that's the issue that ultimately the trial court had to decide. Would they be resolving the case if they allowed this to proceed to decide the issue?
And I believe what the town is attempting to do is to mischaracterize what the case is. They're attempting to say that the case is, can I finish the project? But as I'm approaching it, the question is, do I even bother trying to start the project? Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me begin by dealing with the issue of as-applied versus facial challenge, and let me use Mr. Kasner's own words in his briefs so that I'm not characterizing how this issue has come about. In the brief before this court, on page 20, Mr. Olson referred to this as an as-applied challenge. If you look at his reply brief and main brief in the Court of Appeals, he said, this matter involves, and I'm quoting, both facial and as-applied challenges to the application of an ordinance to Mr. Olson's final plat on page
32. Counselor, but we still can decide the facial challenge that he argues to us today, regardless of what it says in the briefs as combining several issues in this case, correct?
Well, I think you can, but I think that goes to the question of Judge Bartel's discretion.
Well, I want to return to that. I want you to look at 80604, and a lot of focus has been given to subsection 6, which talks about there being discretion, and I understand there's a difference on how you'd like to interpret that. But I'd like you to interpret subsection 12, which talks about construction of this section, as declared to be remedial with its purpose to settle and afford relief from uncertainty and insecurity with respects to rights, status, and other legal relations, and is to be liberally construed and administered. How does that work with what you've been arguing to us about there's unbridled discretion here?
I'm not saying it's unbridled discretion, and certainly there is a remedial purpose, but let me point out, give by example, exactly the problem you have with a facial challenge. Let's assume that this is a facial challenge, despite what all the briefs and the complaints have said up to this point. We have a higher standard than what has been argued on a facial challenge, and if there was a facial challenge, if this goes back to the trial court to proceed on a facial challenge, we're going to have a facial challenge on an ordinance that no longer exists. We have a facial challenge on an ordinance that has been significantly changed, and we're going to have a facial challenge in the context of having neither plat approval nor zoning. And it is because there are changes that occur, not just in the marketplace, but in the ordinances themselves that it's appropriate to have all of the facts ripe, ready to go before issuing a decision. Sending this back for a facial challenge is going to determine nothing on this ordinance that no longer exists.
But perhaps we should interpret the statute, notwithstanding all of the things you tell us, so that folks that want to use it in the future know what parts of it are discretionary and how that discretion, in what parameters, if any, it should be exercised, right? I mean, we aren't just deciding one case, though it's extremely important to both of you. I understand that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's important all the way around. Clearly, the Court of Appeals, in the beginning of their decision, said that this was a de novo review. I don't think that this is de novo review. It ought to be abuse of discretion, precisely for all of the reasons that Mr. Kastner talked about the importance of these issues. It is going to determine a number of significant policy issues, and we ought to have all of the facts together so that the court can make the best decision possible.
Do you view the trial court as applied or facial, and do you view the Court of Appeals as applied or facial, and what is it you want? What message do you want to give us on that?
I think the message is that both of these courts looked at this primarily as an as-applied challenge because that was how the case was postured. And if you go back to Mr. Olson's complaint, it is postured about how this ordinance applies to him, and I think that those issues are discussed in that context because of the way the case was postured. Now, I think even on a facial challenge, as I said, there is still some discretion. I don't think as a matter of jurisprudential policy, this court wants to say to every trial court, you have no discretion when it comes time to hearing a facial challenge to an ordinance.
Counsel, could you give me the cases that find lack of ripeness for facial challenges? I'm missing those.
Well, I don't think that we have a lot of those in Wisconsin, but there are cases, for example, that exist in the federal system. There is, for example, the Seventh Circuit opinion, which is the Commodity Trend Services versus Commodity Future Trading Commission, 149 Fed 3rd 679. And at note 5, it talked about the importance of being able to deal with as applied before you get to facial challenges. They cite a number of cases, but it also goes back to Longshoremen's Union versus Boyd, 347 U.S. 222, 1954 case that said we ought not decide constitutional questions until we absolutely have to and until we have ripe facts. And I would submit until this case has a circumstance in which Mr. Olson will actually be required to obtain TDRs, the case was not ripe, and Judge Bartel properly exercised her discretion in saying, I want more facts, particularly given the mixed nature of this challenge.
If I might, just one last question. Looking again at the statute 80604, how do you view sub 7 of that statute? Orders, judgments, and decrees under this section may be reviewed as other orders, judgments, and decrees. Doesn't that go to the standard of review?
Well, it does in part, and I think that when you look at that, whether it's as a motion to dismiss as in Putnam or on the merits as in District 48, a ripeness determination being inherently fact-based is a discretionary determination. And just as the courts and other discretionary determinations have applied an abuse of discretion standard, so they should here.
Thank you.
I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Kent. Thank you, Mr. Kastner, for your excellent arguments today on an issue relating to ripeness and declaratory judgment in a constitutional attack on a smart growth ordinance. That concludes the hearing on 05AP2257, Walter J. Olson versus Town of Cottage Grove. The court is adjourned until the last part of the month when we continue oral arguments. These those who wish to remain to discuss our procedures with Justice Rogensack shall remain, and the court will meet in closed conference at 1:30. 1:45, I've been requested. So how amenable I am, 1:45 it is.
And we appreciate it, Chief.
And not a problem.